guests and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Good morning and welcome to this September 5th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access our podcast later in the show. But in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter. We're at KUCI FM. Generally our radio station, and then we are also at Writers on Writing on Twitter. I don't do Twitter, but I hear you can find us there sometimes. We are also on Facebook, certainly Writers on Writing. You can find us there. And we are on iTunes, College Radio. You can find us there. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. A really fun morning this morning. We get to do a little bit of memoir. We get to do a little bit of short stories. I'm on now with Sandra Gail Lambert. And in the second half, I'm going to play a pre-recorded interview of Alexia Arthurs. Sandra Gail Lambert is the writer of both fiction and memoir. She is the author of The River's Memory. She was awarded an NEA fellowship based on an excerpt from A Certain Loneliness, which we're chatting about today. A Certain Loneliness was published by Nebraska Press. It's part of the American Live series edited by Tobias Wolf. It's my pleasure to have her on. Sandra, welcome. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good, good. So I'll tell a little story of how I came to this book. I have been a forever fan of Joanne Beard, and I just think she's an incredible essayist. So I called her up a month ago, even though she doesn't have a book coming out, and I confessed my love for her and said she should come on the show. And so
as we all have.
Yeah, right. So she's that'll happen pretty soon. But in the meantime, she said, I never, ever do this, but I have to tell you about this book. And then she went on about your memoir for a very long time.
Oh.
So
you
have Joanne Beard's resounding endorsement, which she tells me she never gives out. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. That just sort of makes me get sweaty all over.
Right.
Such a compliment.
It would, yeah. So I was going to do some stage setting for this memoir, but I think that's probably best left to you. And I'll let you kind of set this up and take us inside A Certain certain Loneliness and your decision to write it.
I don't think I had a decision to write it. I was writing a novel, and then I started writing essays as well. And, you know, when you write a novel, you're sort of, there's nothing to submit anywhere for years. And I would write essays, personal essays, and they were starting to get accepted, which, you know, felt really good. So I wrote more of them. And a lot of those ended up being what A Certain Loneliness became what A Certain Loneliness is today. But that was a long process. I think some of the first essays that writings that I wrote for that book may have originally been written in the early 1990s.
Wow.
Not most of them. Most of them were in, you know, within the last 10 years. But there were a few much older that I pulled in as well. So there wasn't ever any one decision. But there was a point where I thought, I have a lot of pages here. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking how I could make a memoir out of it. And that's, I think, when the decision happened, when I started to do that work.
I really love this format of a memoir in essays, and so it sounds like that process really came about very organically, that it was never the case that you were going to sit down with sort of a, I don't know if it's a more traditional arc of, you know, here's how it began and here's how it ended, but that format of,
you know,
in essays is great.
And some of them are just, I tried to make them very interconnected. Some of them are more narrative essays. They're about a specific thing that happened, like kayaking by myself in the Everglades at sunrise. Mm-hmm. I didn't mess with that one. That's in A Certain Loneliness, pretty much the way it was when it was an essay that I was submitting. I mean, I've rewritten part of it. Hopefully it's better. But other ones were more reflexive, and they would follow sort of meandering theme, thread or topic throughout my life, like swimming or you know, loneliness, or even my menstrual period. And those essays I sort of pulled apart and wrapped around each other and presented them in, you can't find those essays as they were published anywhere in the book. They've been pulled apart and put back together again. Hopefully that's what helps the structure out.
Right, exactly. So we should clue our listeners in, if they are not yet familiar with you, about kind of the contours of your life story. You know, a lot of our listeners probably don't know the the scope of things you have been through. So kind of introduce us also to your life in general.
Okay, well, let me start with my writing life, which didn't start until I was in my 40s, not in any sort of serious way. And I don't have any sort of academic background in writing. But when I started writing, I started writing about my life, and it included that I had polio as a baby in the early 50s, that I used braces and crutches most of my life, and then when it became just a better choice for mobility, I moved to a wheelchair in the late 80s. Also during that time, of course, I was a young lesbian and coming out and figuring that out, and in a time when the words were just not available, or if they were, they were very negative. I was figuring out how the natural world was a sort of solace for me, and that came and went throughout my life. So that's another sort of intersection of themes. And also desire, bodily desire was an important part of what I wrote about in the book as well, and in the essays that I wrote. So there, all those are lenses through which I do my writing. I don't know if one is more important than the other. I think that varies according to when I'm writing about and what's going on in my life at the time.
Right, right. I know you were always a reader, and you say you didn't come to professional writing until later, but were you like a journal keeper? Or you know, some of those early essays are so visceral, and I was wondering if you had kept journals throughout that time to rely on.
I did do journals a little bit. I've never looked back at them. Mm-hmm. I do keep what I call trip notes. When I go on a trip anywhere or to a state park, I did a lot of writing and traveling in state parks. I keep trip notes that include, I guess they would be called a journal, but they include everything from geological formations where I am to what flowers are blooming to what anxieties I'm having at the time. I just keep pretty extensive, quick trip journals. And sometimes it's 10 years later that I look back at those and they become the basis for an essay.
Very nice. My guest this morning is Sandra Gale Lambert, the book A Certain Loneliness. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. There's so many wonderful lessons in these essays for writers. One of those, writers are generally told, or I hear a lot, you know, go deeper. You haven't gone deep enough. Mm-hmm. You haven't accessed, you know, the real pain here or whatever they're told, especially in the memoir form. And so how do you know when you have gone deep enough? And, you know, these essays really feel very poignant and visceral and alive and all of those things that it feels like essays are trying to aim for, and everyone either writes around the issue or they don't quite go really to the heart of the nugget. And it seems like you do that just so naturally. And I was wondering if you have any tips on how to do that.
Well, that's interesting, because a criticism I've gotten as I was learning to, you know, I was always searching out ways to write better. And one of the criticisms I always got was that I didn't go deep enough.
Wow.
That I didn't. And I think that came from me being unwilling. I am literally a little kid that was surrounded by all the medical doctors and naked, and they had access to me. So I have very strong feelings about what I'm going to share and what I'm not going to share. And I get to do that, and I don't think it's any less honest writing than anyone who does share. And many writers share really deeply in a powerful way. But I think the way I could make my writing with me maintaining my emotional modesty, which I have and I think I get to have, the same way I didn't get to have physical modesty when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. I write a lot about the body, and I think people relate to that in a way. If I write what the body is feeling and what the body is actually doing and how it negotiates the world, I think that is probably what gives it my writing a sense of depth.
Yes, right. So as you're describing that, do you view the body as a writer, are you able to separate the body? Almost sounds like a third person away from you. This is what the body experiences as opposed to this is what I'm experiencing. Does that make sense?
Yes, and those can be separate things. And even when I'm writing fiction, if I get stuck, I ask, okay, what is this character's body doing right now? How is it feeling? Uh-huh. Is it hurting? Is it having sensual feelings? What is going on? And I do that with myself sometimes as well, especially when I'm writing writing about childhood or teenage things that are many decades ago.
It's so interesting you're saying this. I hadn't thought about this before, but it's almost like approaching writing as a doctor or a scientist would approach medicine, you know, that, I'm just having this experience of, listening to, I know a woman who was married to a doctor, and when he died, after he was dead, but he's still laying there, she started referring to him as the patient instead of as her husband. And
wow.
It struck me then, as it strikes me now, that you're talking similarly about this, and maybe that I've never thought of this before. I'm just thinking out loud right now, but that's a very interesting way for writers maybe who are struggling to get deeper or struggling to become more in touch with whatever their emotions are to access it that way, just as a door in, and then you can, you know, maybe that's a door into to exploring something deeper, but thinking about this almost medically or clinically to give yourself access to something that's really painful to write about.
That's interesting as well. I mean, writers with disabilities write all sorts of things in all sorts of ways, but we very seldom leave the body out of the writing.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that gives our writing a certain power, and I think it would give anyone's writing a certain power if you pay attention to the body itself.
Yeah, really interesting. The other thing that this does for writing, I think that's another trap for a lot of writers, is remove the sentimentality that can,
yeah,
you know, the purple prose that can become problematic for writers, especially, you know, maybe for memoirists. And this never slips into that. And I was wondering if that was conscious on your part or if that was just an organic result.
It's a combination of both. I abhor that, especially in writings about disability, especially by non-disabled people, that sort of purple prose, as you called it, is rampant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a aversion to it. But I also think it's organic in the way I write as well. To not have that here, sometimes the phrase sentimentality is used to sort of put down writing by women, and I'm not doing that here. I'm talking about a different thing. And I like to write just clear, this is what happened, this is what I was feeling, this is the reactions of the people around me. And one of the things I give up by doing it that way is I don't get to tell people how they should think about what I'm writing. But to me, it's a fair trade-off.
Well, and I think that's always the goal, is to not tell people what they should think about your writing. You know, I mean, this is really the very classic show, don't tell approach.
Yeah, but sometimes don't you just want to?
Of course, yeah. Every writer wants to. Just so much more effective when they don't.
Yes.
It also struck me that writing would be perhaps, I don't know if you feel this way, such a wonderful freedom from your physicality that, you know, you can go anywhere in your writing that maybe is difficult for you to access physically, but what a wonderful way to travel without having to go through all the, you know, difficulties of travel. It just strikes me as the perfect profession.
Well, I do travel a lot, and I do go a lot of places. I don't think I've ever not been somewhere.
Yeah.
Because I use a wheelchair, because I use braces and crutches. I mean, I've not been places because of financial reasons and time reasons. But it is something that I can do that doesn't – it renews me and gives me energy rather than some other things like if I did some sort of art, which I don't have the talent for, I could see where it would – I would have to physically pace that. And writing, I have to pace in a certain way, but not in a physical way.
I love that you came to writing later in life. And, I talked to so many writers who started when they were in their 40s, you know, started publishing in their 50s mm-hmm. or 60s. And what the wonderful authority of voice that gives them. And, you know, unlike athletics where you burn out in your 20s, writing just gets better and better as you get older and older. And I was wondering if you had no formal training as a writer, and I was wondering how you established that community for yourself or your support system or your, you know, writing life when you're coming to it later in life, because I think a lot of people are in that boat.
I was part of a vibrant lesbian feminist community in the 70s and the 80s, and we knew how to make community. We made bookstores and publishing houses and social engagements and political work. And we all we had was each other in that time. It was a rough time. And so I had those skills, and I had the belief that was important. So when I started sort of going out to conferences or workshops, I would always try to meet other people that I thought I could be supportive of or they could be supportive of me. And I always tried to gather a community or have me included in one. And so that was always important. And it worked really well. And then, of course, Facebook and other social media happened, and that was just an easy way to keep in touch with people that you didn't, rather than emailing or sending letters or however we used to do it before.
I love that. Do you ever do writing conferences and some of those things and find those useful?
I have in the past, and it was a great way for me to get the input from people more accomplished than I was. That was always such a helpful thing for me because I didn't have an academic, I didn't go to MFA, I didn't have that. And that, so I was out there writing, and I had no idea whether it was any good or not, or if it was good, why it was good. I started to get it published, so I assume it was decent. It was so helpful to get feedback from the very basics. Like the first place I went was the Atlantic Center for the Arts, and I didn't know anything about literary journals. It was there that I found out that there were such a thing, mm-hmm. that my writing fit in them, and that you could send your work out to them.
Right. Yeah, I think, as writers, especially writers that have come to writing later in life and don't necessarily want to go through the MFA program, it's important to find out where to find these communities, what's helpful, where their time and energy and money is best spent. And I do think these little enclaves of either summer workshops or, finding your own community of writing critique groups or however you do that, it's an important thing. Writing is so isolating as it is that it's nice to be able to sniff each other out.
I do a lot of that. I've written a lot by getting in my wheelchair lift van with the bed in the back and going to state parks around Florida and doing writing retreats there for myself. And much of my writing has happened in that space, sitting in that van.
The car.
But once you've done that, you know, and had that necessary isolation, of course you have to have community. And one of the things, even if I go to a conference and it's sort of a bust, I figure if I make one new writing friend, it was worth it.
Right, right.
That's sort of my bottom line.
Right. I don't know why it is that cars are so, they're such an effective place to write. I love writing in my car.
Yeah.
There's nothing else you can do, so you have to sit there. Wi-Fi is limited, so it's great. So I would.
You can only listen. Oh, go ahead.
No, no, go ahead. You can. Yeah, you can only.
I was saying, just going to make a joke about you can only listen to, you know, classic rock for so long on your radio.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how long I can do that. But yes, you're right. I can do anything to procrastinate from writing. So one thing I love to do, and if we could do this together for an essay or two, it's just a kind of, I don't know, it's more fun for me than anyone else probably, but I love to take an essay or two, and maybe it is one of the essays in here that gave you the most trouble. Maybe it is one of the most recent essays or the essay that got picked apart the most, but choose one of these. I'll let you choose it, and we can just dissect it. We can take it from its first kernel of the beginning of an idea and watch it change and evolve and all of your artistic choices that you made along the way to make it what it became and kind of your revision process and how you titled it, anything you want to say about one of these essays that we can just kind of pick apart and do a quick Sandra Lambert study on. The making of one of these.
Okay, I'm going for the table of contents here. Well, the one that came to mind is the essay that doesn't exist in here, which was, it was called A Certain Loneliness. And it's the one that is the most pulled apart. So it doesn't exist as a separate essay in the book.
But I
can choose one that excuse me?
I said, I kind of love that. You know, I mean, even if it doesn't exist, we could talk about how it, so it sounds like the seeds of it sort of scattered all over the rest of the book.
It is. And it's, I wrote this long meandering essay called A Certain Loneliness. And somehow I felt like it was really important. You know, you get that feeling sometimes. Mm-hmm. Not that it was necessarily really good, but it was really important. And I brought it with me to, I went to the Atlantic Center for the Arts this last time, and Carolyn Forche was the leader of that group for 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And she was doing poetry and memoir. And she read it, and she just looked at me, and she said, Sandra, this is a scaffold. There's all these places you need to put other essays. Like right here, you need to put an essay about kayaking. And right here, you need to put one about being in high school. And I already had those essays. She didn't know that. But every one she mentioned, I had those essays. Mm. So I realized that I needed to go home and I needed to pull that essay apart, the Certain Loneliness one, and insert all of those other essays in it. Which I did by old-fashioned cut and paste. I cleared the dining room table off. I made synopses of each of the essays of the whole, what I had as a coming together as a book. I put little, and I spread them out, and then I cut up the Certain Loneliness essay, and then I found a couple of others I thought I should cut up as well. And I just put all the, I just started moving them around, just physically moving them around on the table. And they just fell into place, I mean, over about a week. But it worked really well. And that's how I came up with not the final, I tweaked it a lot more, but that's how I came up with the structure of this memoir.
Wow. So what do you think it was about that original essay that wasn't working, that made it scaffolding instead of essay?
Well, clearly there were holes in it. Mm. You know, there were places where the reader was going, wait a minute. I mean, according to Carolyn Forche, and then when I read it again, where the reader would go, wait a minute, you skipped something here, or this, or the essay wasn't cohesive enough mm-hmm. to be on its own.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, I mean, it did get published on its own in, now I've forgotten where. Anyway, I can't remember right now. But it did get published on its own. But it was the one that I could pull apart and use as my guide, as my structure.
And do you think it was lacking? Because the essays that are included are really, a lot of them are centered around a particular event, kind of a particular narrative structure. And I was wondering if that original essay kind of composed a lot of your ideas, but maybe not as much narrative, or maybe not as many scenes.
Yes, it was much more reflective than mm-hmm. many of my essays.
Right.
Didn't have that sort of concrete thing that the other ones do. Very reflective.
Uh-huh.
It was originally, it's come to me now, it was originally published in Waterstone Review. But, so they liked it enough, you know, it worked. But when I was thinking about A Certain Loneliness as the whole, as the memoir, it was the one that I could use to structure everything else. And it just worked really, I was amazed how the slots just sort of fit into each other.
Yeah.
There were some gaps. It also showed gaps when I did that. You know, when you do that, it not only shows you where to put things, it shows you absences or places there that you need to write another essay or you need to write more fully about something. It shows you where you need to write that next paragraph or that next essay.
Right, right. And tell me a little bit about the ordering of the essays. It kind of felt roughly chronological, but not entirely chronological. But tell me a little bit about that process.
That was extremely, I think you can't use the word haphazard because that sounds terrible. It was organic, let's use that word.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I just kept working it and working it and working it. And it was, you know, the ending of one needed to flow into the beginning of the other. And that didn't work a lot of times. And I had to restructure until that worked. That was really important to me, that it, even though it's a memoir in essays, I didn't want it to be simply a group of essays. I wanted each one to flow into the next or reflect back on the one before. And so that determined the order of them. I did write a few essays later after I was doing this process to fill in gaps and to make that more possible, places I needed. The same way a poet will write a bunch of poems and then be putting together a collection and then write poems for the collection. I did the same thing with a few of the essays.
Did this?
But it was to the very last moment. Some things were changing. Like when I gave it to University of Nebraska Press, the first section was at the end, and the reader that they had for it said, you know, she liked it and all, but she wanted that moved to the beginning. And the minute she said that, I knew that was the right thing to do.
Hmm. A good editor is worth everything, right?
Yes. Yes.
So having come through the process of writing a novel and a book of essays, memoir and essays, can you leave us with writing advice, things that you have learned along the way or things that sustain you? I know you're a very disciplined writer. But what can you tell us?
Well, the biggest thing for me is whenever I was working with someone that was more accomplished than I was, I would always ask them, what is the next thing I need to do to make my writing better? And that question has really helped me. You know, they get to give me one concrete thing to work on. Hmm. And that has helped me more than anything else.
Who do you know?
And you can ask yourself that, you know.
Yeah. I was going to say, who do you know who to trust when you're asking that question?
You can feel it. Okay. You know, I mean, the late, great Maggie Eastep told me that my dialogue sucked. I knew she was right when she said, I mean, you just know they're right when they say certain things. And you've been in a workshop with them for either a day or 3 weeks or whatever it is. And so you know whether you even want to ask them that question.
Yeah.
You know, whether you have a certain trust in them.
Right. Whether they understand your work enough to comment on it. Yeah.
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 Sandra Gale Lambert, this was such a pleasure. I'm going to direct people to your website, which I think is just, tell me your website. It's a wonderful website.
SandraGaleLambert.com.
That's what I thought. Okay. So we can find you there. And there are a number of really wonderful interviews that you have done, including an interview with Joanne Beard that you did up there. You will be appearing nowhere in California, but I know you're doing a book tour that people can find you on if they live in your Florida area. There's a bunch of good stuff.
Also, I'll be at Southern Festival of Books in Nashville as well.
Oh, great. Oh, great, great, great. And you're on, are you on Facebook? Go ahead.
Excuse me?
I was going to say, and then are you on Facebook and do you do all those kind of social media things?
I am. I'm on Facebook as Sandra Lambert, and I'm on Twitter as Sandra Lambert, and I'm on Instagram a little bit.
So we can stalk you any number of ways.
Any number of ways.
Sandra Lambert, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.